your dad? Lil asks. Of course he told her, Summer cuts in. I would. She was bummed, I admit, and ticked off at him too. She'd said she didn't want me to come out here, but I think secretly she did. I think she wanted us to reconnect. The eagle nest sits so high that we can't see over the rim. The babies could be hunkered down low, waiting for their parents to bring them a fish. Whatever happens with me and Dad, this has still been a cool trip, I say. Lil pulls back on the oars. It's not over yet. After catching a few more trout, Summer asks to switch seats again. She wants to finish her book, and it's only 2 miles until we reach the takeout ramp. I'm happy to be back in the bow, concentrating on making good casts and not thinking about my father. That's another great thing about fly fishing. Doing it right requires your complete, undivided attention. Lil says lots of her customers are successful big city business executives who are desperate to escape the grind of their jobs. She mutes their phones before they step into the boat, and she says they always thank her at the end of the float. I believe it. All day long, a warm downstream breeze has nudged us along, but now we turn a bend, and the air goes dead still. Here, the river is broad and lazy. Something that looks like a shaggy brown coconut pops to the surface. Summer says it's a beaver. Once he spots us, he whacks his flat tail, pow, and dives. I watch for his face to poke up again, but Lil says he's probably hiding in his den, a mud-packed heap of branches at the mouth of a small creek. Summer explains that the entrance to the den is underwater. Lil rows closer, and as the current sweeps us past, I snap another picture for Mom. There are definitely no wild beavers in South Florida. The fish have quit biting, and I don't mind. There's nothing boring about being here. It's nice to be the only humans in sight. Summer is the first to hear the humming, because I'm tuned into a bunch of squabbling redwings. She slaps her book shut and says, I can't believe this. Lil lets go of the oars and stands up, hands planted on her hips. All this drama, she murmurs, frowning. What are you guys talking about? I say. Then I hear it too. The drone. It's hovering downriver, pointed our way, watching us. This is why the blackbirds are so riled. Lil shakes a finger at the quadcopter. Knock it off, Dennis! If I were my father, I'd pay attention. As the drone comes closer, Summer rises from her seat. Yo, up there! Is that really you? Of course it's him, snaps Lil. The little gray quadcopter tilts back and forth, as if nodding. So I guess it's my turn. I speak extra slowly in case he's lip-reading from the video feed. Dad! Why are you doing this? The drone glides forward until it's directly above the boat, so low I can practically poke it with the tip of the fly rod. I'm tempted to try, but I don't. If I touch just one of the moving propellers, the aircraft will go haywire and fall, probably on top of my head. Dennis, have you lost your mind? Lil hollers. Now that the drone is so close, the buzzing of the blades is annoying. Summer plugs her ears with her fingers. I stare at the unblinking eye of the quadcopter's camera, imagining my father staring back at me from... where? Depending on the strength of the signal, he could be operating the flight controls from high on a canyon rim, or the middle of a hayfield, or even the back of his truck. One thing is certain, he's not far away. Where are you? I call to the invisible pilot. The drone wobbles slightly, and a small shiny packet tumbles from a compartment on its underside. I reach up to catch the falling object, but I miss. Splash! No! Stretching over the side of the boat, I try to grab the packet before it disappears underwater. But it doesn't sink. It floats.
Bubble wrap, Lil grumbles, rowing quickly downriver in pursuit.
Dad's quadcopter follows us by air. I scoop up the little package and unpeel the wrapping. Inside is another neatly written note, and what looks like somebody's molar. It's yours, Billy, the note informs me. The first one you ever lost. Seriously? Summer says. Now he's the Tooth Fairy? I lock eyes on the hovering spy craft and wonder how my father expects me to react. The yellowed nub in my hand is small enough to be kid-sized, but so what? I drop it in my pocket and read the last line of the note. See you in Florida, it says. 7. So here I am, bagging groceries at Publix again. After returning from Montana, I tried to find a job outdoors where I could mostly be by myself. No luck. A golf course in our neighborhood had openings on the landscape crew, but the manager said I wasn't old enough to drive the riding mowers. He said their insurance policy didn't allow them to hire kids, which is why I ended up back at the supermarket. Belinda's working at TJ Maxx, and Mom's still driving for Uber. She didn't get fired for kicking that creep out of her car, but the company put her on probation. They said one more incident, and she's gone. Publix gives me 20 hours a week, which leaves plenty of free time to go snake hunting west of town in the dead orange groves and ranch scrub. Mostly what you find out there are banded water snakes and garter snakes, but on the dry patches you'll sometimes luck into a speckled king snake or a corn snake. What I like best about hunting snakes is the peace. All you hear are wild birds and your own footsteps. It's a long bicycle ride from where we live, so sometimes Mom gives me a lift. She downloaded the Uber app to my phone so I can call her to come get me when she's between customers. One afternoon, I'm walking back toward town along Highway 70 when an old junker pulls off the road. The engine sounds like a washing machine full of chipped rocks. It clatters and shakes for a minute, then conks out. A young driver emerges. He's wearing a faded black hoodie and dragging on a cigarette, which raises the possibility that he's not a genius. There's a neon blue skull tattooed on his bony right arm. The skull is smoking a cigarette, too.
What's in the bag? He asks me.
I open the pillowcase and show him.
Oh, expletive, he cries, scrambling to the other side of the car.
They're harmless, I say.
I heard of you, bro. You the snake boy.
The kid isn't exactly a model of good hygiene. His teeth are stained brown from the tobacco, and his pale skin looks blotchy and pitted. He's got small brown eyes and a homemade buzz cut. I can't stop staring at the skull tattoo. Everyone at school still talks about it. Hello, Jammer, I say. He looks pleased that I know who he is.
You the one got my old locker, bro?
Yeah. Can I ask why it smells so bad?
Dirty laundry and stuff, he says.
Oh, come on.
Yo, I was living in the boys' bathroom at the F building, the one next to where the band practices. That was my crib for like half the year.
How'd you end up there?
'Cause my stepdad threw me out of the apartment. Everything I owned got put in that locker. Socks, shirts, jock straps. Some of it got washed, some didn't.
Jammer offers his own version of why he got expelled from school.
Some dude's Jeep got jacked after a football game. The cops found it, but they said there's a laptop missing from under the seat. They said it was me that stole it, but see, I was at my girlfriend's house when all that expletive went down. She was going to testify for me too, but then her family moved back to Dallas. So I copped a plea and went to juvie. Yo, there's no way to fight back when the whole system's rigged against you.
Rigged how? I asked.
Hell, I'd still be in school if I was a rich boy like you. They wouldn't have gone and kicked me out.
We're not rich. Where'd you get that idea?
Yeah, right, he says.
I check to make sure I'm wearing what I think I'm wearing. A dirty t-shirt, board shorts, and nasty mud-splattered sneakers.
Does this look like I shop at Vineyard Vines? I say.
Jammer shrugs.
The cop set me up as all. Know what I'm saying? I bet they never mess with you.
What's wrong with your car?
Fan belt. Can I use your cell, bro? Mine's dead.
I toss my phone to Jammer because he won't come anywhere near me in my snake bag. He dials a number and tells, not asks, somebody to come pick him up. Afterward, he slides the phone back to me across the hood of the Junker.
Why'd you give out your locker combination to so many people? I ask.
Just friends. They messing with your stuff?
Not anymore. You put a badass snake in that locker is what I heard.
That's ultra sick, man.
Nobody got hurt.
Yo, can I have like $5?
Jammer's gaze drops again to the pillowcase in my hand. Know what? Never mind.
Did the police ever find that missing laptop?
I ain't sure they ever was a laptop. Know what I'm saying?
See you later, man. I start walking away.
Bro, what's your true name? He calls after me.
Billy Big Stick.
What's that mean?
Ever heard of the Crow Indians?
Is that, like, a baseball team?
I turn around. FYI, cigarettes choke off the arteries to your brain. You should really quit.
Jammer waves lightheartedly and blows a circle of smoke. I walk way down the road before stopping to call my mother.
Minutes later, a rusty SUV with bald wheels honks as it speeds past. Jammer grins at me from the passenger seat. The driver is looking down, totally texting on his phone. My feelings aren't the least bit hurt when they don't stop to offer me a ride. In fact, I'm relieved. When Mom finally arrives, I get in on the passenger side. A middle-aged man sits in the back seat. He's wearing a short-sleeved uniform shirt from Taco Bell. I've never laid eyes on him before.
Billy, this is Mr. Randolph. I'm driving him to work.
Hi there, Billy, says Mr. Randolph. My wife's sister borrowed my ride. That's why I'm Ubering.
I look sharply at Mom, who pretends to be concentrating on the traffic. She's not supposed to transport family members while she's driving a paying customer.
What's in the sack?
Her passenger asks me pleasantly.
Nothing, my mother cuts in. His lunch, that's all.
She doesn't want poor Mr. Randolph leaping from her car at 50 miles per hour, which might very well happen if he learns the pillowcase is full of squirming reptiles. I play along.
Yeah, it's just my lunch.
After we drop Mr. Randolph off at the Taco Bell, I remind Mom about the importance of sticking to the Uber company's rules. She acts like she's agreeing, but I know better.
I just don't want you getting in any more trouble, I say.
You're a good kid for worrying about me so much.
But you're still gonna do things your own way, right?
She says she spotted a small drone flying above the house today.
I swear it followed me to the post office.
What did it look like?
Gray, she replies, with a dark stripe on the bottom.
You're sure it was gray?
It made me think about your father.
Lots of people have drones, I say.
Right, I know, but why would this one follow me?
Mom, it's probably just some neighborhood kids fooling around.
I still haven't told her about Dad's bubble-wrapped note that said he was coming to Florida. There's no point getting her all worked up, in case he never makes it. Anyway,
I'm not even sure she'd want to see him. Back at the house, Mom goes inside to start dinner while I head for the garage. There, I open the pillowcase, remove the 4 snakes I caught, and lock them in one of the larger aquarium tanks. Then I rummage through a bunch of cardboard boxes until I find what I'm looking for. My slingshot. One of the first things I did after returning from Montana was ride my bike to the dentist's office and show her the tooth my father delivered by drone. "Well, it's definitely a human molar and definitely from a child," she said, "but I can't say if it came from your mouth or somebody else's." "What about a DNA test?" "We don't do that sort of thing here, Billy. The question doesn't come up very often." I've been home a week and still haven't told Mom or Belinda about the tooth. Don't worry, I'm not keeping it under my pillow or anything. I hid it in the plastic case that holds the dental retainer I almost never wear. But let's say the tooth was really mine. Is that supposed to prove Dad cares about me? Just because he saved a dingy little chomper all these years? He'll have to do better than that. One morning I'm working at the supermarket when I spot Chin, the kid who got jumped by the lacrosse player at school. He's waiting in the checkout line with a man who looks identical to him, only older. He calls the man Pop. Chin looks totally recovered from the beatdown. The bruise above his eye has healed, and the bandage over his ear is gone. I try not to look at him or his dad while I'm bagging their groceries, a gallon of low-fat milk, a package of free-range chicken breasts, a head of romaine lettuce, 2 pints of Häagen-Dazs, vanilla and chocolate, 6 tomatoes, a can of black beans, a bunch of carrots. But Chin recognizes me. And now it gets awkward. If either of us says something, then Chin will have to explain to his father who I am and how we met. What happened in the school hallway that day is probably something he doesn't want to talk about, and I'd rather not be part of that conversation. Finally, we make eye contact. He nods. I nod. That's it. Chin and his dad walk out of the store with their grocery bags. I'm feeling that I handled the situation pretty smoothly until I look at the checkout counter and see I forgot to bag one small item. Dental floss. Waxed, with spearmint flavoring. I can't believe I missed it. Seriously. The cashier hands me the little box of floss, saying, "Go take it to those customers. Hurry up now, they paid for it." So I jog to the parking lot and hunt down Chin and his father, who are arranging their groceries in the trunk of a small sedan. I step up and say, "Sorry, I forgot to bag this." My tone is painfully polite. Chin studies me, standing there in my goofy green Publix apron. I'm not sure what he's thinking. His dad takes the dental floss and tries to tip me a dollar, but I shake my head, saying, "No, sir, that's not necessary." I turn around and propel myself back toward the entrance of the supermarket.
"Hey, thanks!"
a voice calls out. A kid's voice. It's Chin, not his dad. I don't look back.
"You're welcome,"
I say over my shoulder. Mom swings by to pick me up after I get off from work. On the way home, I ask out of the blue if it was she or Dad who used to do the tooth fairy thing when Belinda and I were little.
"It was always me," she says. "You didn't lose your first baby tooth until you were 5 1/2 years old. Dennis was already gone by then, Billy."
Oh. Gone on his great Wild West adventure. Right.
"What made you think to ask?"
"No reason," I say. Back at the house, I walk straight to my bathroom, pluck the little yellow molar out of my retainer case, and flush it down the toilet. I'm still in a crappy mood later when Dawson shows up. Belinda invited him for dinner. She makes a point of holding his hand, a reminder to Mom, "See how much I care about him? Please don't make us move again."
I feel like telling my sister her romance act is unnecessary. Mom hasn't said a word about moving because the bald eagles are still happily sharing their nest on the Indian River. We faithfully check on them every Sunday morning. Basically, it's our version of church.
Dawson wants to go with us to see the birds next time, Belinda says.
Mom, who's broiling pork chops, says that would be fine.
Bring some binoculars, I suggest.
Dude, I've got something so much better, says Dawson. My dad's camera. Just the lens cost 10 grand.
Wow. Is it made from diamonds? I ask with a straight face.
It's a 500mm telephoto.
So that's what, 20 bucks per millimeter?
Belinda says, knock it off, Billy. Look, I know camera equipment is expensive. I just can't stand listening to people brag. Dawson is so dim that he doesn't even get that I'm roasting him.
Mom asks if his father is a professional photographer.
Oh no, he's a venture capitalist, Dawson replies. His specialty is funding startup tech companies. You know, the Googles of the future.
Now I'm ready to lose it, so I slip outside to practice with my slingshot. Our next-door neighbor has a tall palm tree that's full of green coconuts. I'm shooting copper BBs that bounce harmlessly off the thick husks. My aim is pretty good. Of course, the coconuts are just hanging there on stems. It's not like trying to hit a moving target.
Dawson ambles out the front door and asks what I'm doing as if it isn't obvious. He eyes the slingshot and says,
"Hey, dude, let me try."
This might turn out badly, but I can't come up with a reason to say no. I guess I don't want to hurt the guy's feelings.
"You ever used a slingshot before?" I ask.
"Are you kidding? My cousin's got one that's solid titanium. It's like shooting a 22.
"Well, this one is plain old oak."
"Here, Billy, observe and learn."
Dawson snatches the Y-shaped piece of wood from my hand and grabs some BBs from the jar. His first shot somehow misses the entire tree. I hear the little copper ball plop into our neighbor's swimming pool. Dawson's second try pings off the trunk of the palm. His next shot lands at his feet because his fingers tangle in the rubber bands. Finally, he manages to nick one of the larger coconuts. Then he hits two more in a row.
"Now I'm officially bored," he declares,
and turns to take aim at a calico cat that's been watching us from the cherry bushes. I can't say what happens next, but it happens fast. Dawson ends up flat on the ground with my knees on his chest. He seems to be having trouble speaking. The cat scampers off as I twist the slingshot out of Dawson's hand and fling it aside. I don't do this in a particularly gentle way. Although he's bigger than I am, Dawson can't shake me off. His face goes red and he splutters furiously. After he throws a wild punch, I pin his arms, saying,
"If you don't shut up, Belinda's gonna hear you. I'm guessing you don't want her to see this, right? Her boyfriend getting thumped by her little brother?"
Dawson quits thrashing and catches his breath. His face returns to its normal color, though I wouldn't say he looks calm.
"Why would you want to shoot somebody's pet cat?" I ask. "Where's the sport in that? You're pathetic."
He opens his mouth to reply, but no sound comes out. He's staring past me, over my shoulder, at something in the air above us. It's not a bird, either. I can hear those little propellers humming. Dawson cranes his sweaty neck to get a better look.
"What's that thing doing?"
he wheezes. I climb off of him and pick up my slingshot.
"Go inside now," I say.
Then I grab a handful of BBs. 8.
"Dad, is that you?"
I ask the gray quadcopter. Dumb question. Who else would be spying on our house?
Dinner's ready,
my mother calls from inside. She doesn't see what I'm seeing.
Be right there, Mom.
After loading a BB into the pouch, I raise the slingshot and draw back the heavy-duty rubber bands. To counter the light crosswind, I aim a little left of dead center. The first BB sails too high. Instantly, the drone begins to elevate. I reload and shoot again. This time, there's the sharp crack of metal on plastic. Something flies off the top of the quadcopter and flutters like a leaf to the ground. It's part of a prop blade. Down comes the drone, twirling in a sickly spiral. It crash lands in the middle of our yard, shredding grass. I pounce on the crippled aircraft and carry it into the garage, yanking the door down behind me. At the dinner table, Dawson won't look me in the eye. He's afraid I'm going to tell Belinda he tried to shoot the cat. She and Mom are doing most of the talking, as usual. This evening's subject is the end of good manners in modern civilization. Belinda had a bad experience at TJ Maxx today, a customer who flamed her for taking too long to count out his change. Mom definitely overcooked the pork chops, but I'm not saying a word. This is why knives were invented. There was a cat in the yard, I say innocently. Cute little calico. Across the table, Dawson goes pale. His fork stops halfway to his lips. Mom says, "Oh, that must be Mrs. Gomez's." I nod. "What's its name again?" "Muffin." "She's supposed to be an inside kitty," my sister says, "but she probably snuck out the back door again." Dawson finally gets the bite of pork chop to his mouth. He chews grimly, staring down at his plate. I'm not letting him off the hook. "How long ago was it that Mr. Gomez passed away?" I ask my mother.
"Right after Christmas."
"Seems like yesterday. That was really sad."
"Just tragic," Mom agrees.
"Heart attack," Belinda informs Dawson. "He gave little Muffin to Mrs. Gomez as a present on their last wedding anniversary. Can you pass the mashed potatoes?" Dawson looks like he wants to shrivel up and crawl under the table. In other words, he looks like a person who almost shot a heartbroken widow's beloved pet. My sister would dump him in a nanosecond if she knew what he'd done, so he desperately hopes I won't say another word about it. And I probably won't, if he starts behaving like a respectable member of the human species. "Save room for dessert," Mom says. "I made a key lime pie." Belinda and I are clearing the dishes when somebody knocks at the front door. My heart starts racing because I assume the visitor is Dennis Dickens, my elusive father, arriving to retrieve his expensive quadcopter. Mom takes one step toward the door, but I get there first. The man standing on the front step isn't my dad. It's a much younger guy with no shirt, tanned arms, and stringy, sun-bleached hair. Two sandy surfboards are strapped to the roof of his rainbow-colored van. "Yo," the young guy says, "you see a drone come down around here?" Using his salt-crusted hands, he indicates the size of the missing craft. From behind, I hear Mom asking who it is. "One of the neighbors," I say, and slip outside to speak to the surfer dude. Everyone calls him Limpy. I've seen his beach van around town. Limpy tells me he was practicing with his quadcopter when the signal went all sketch and the aircraft drifted out of control. I take the broken prop blade out of my pocket and drop it in his hand. He looks at it and says, "Not good." I open the garage to show him the drone. "It crashed in our yard," I say.
"Bummer."
He lifts the quadcopter and starts trudging to his van. I notice he doesn't have a limp, so I'm wondering how he got his nickname.
"Later, dude," he says.
Now it's decision time,
one of those moral crossroads that Mom talks about. Since Limpy has no clue what actually happened to his drone, it would be easy for me to let him think it was just a mechanical glitch. Except I feel lousy about what I did, so I hurry after him, saying, "Hey, wait up! I'm really sorry, but I shot down your drone with a slingshot. I want to pay for the repairs." A different look comes over his face, though it's not anger. It's curiosity. "How come you shot it?" he asks. "'Cause I thought it belonged to someone else. Long story, man, but I want to give you some money to get it fixed." Limpy shrugs. "No worries, dude. One of these suckers buzzed my house, I'd probably plug it too." He smiles and sets the aircraft in the back of the van. "You must be really pro with that slingshot." "Let me pay for the damage, please." "No way. A new prop can't cost that much. We're cool." He climbs into his van, which smells like sunblock and stale sweat. On the passenger seat is a crumpled tank top and three empty beer cans. "You okay to drive?" I say. Limpy chuckles and hitches his eyebrows. "Dude, seriously?" Like I don't know a thing about the grown-up life. I ask if he uses the quadcopter to make surfing videos. He pauses to think about it before answering, "Yeah, for sure." He drives away in a fairly straight line. I'm nagged by the feeling that he should have been unhappy, even angry about what I did to his drone. His chill reaction seems weird. Walking back to the front door, I step over the divot where the drone came down hard. Lying in the grass is something I hadn't noticed before, a small, bright piece of plastic. The shape is thin and rectangular. As soon as I pick it up, I know exactly what I'm looking at. The factory label says 64G. It's an SD card, a memory chip for electronic devices. Cell phones use SD cards. Cameras use SD cards. So do drones. I pocket the card and hurry inside to help finish with the dishes, but they're already done. Mom's on the phone while Belinda and Dawson are watching some lame reality show where five supermodels who hate each other are stranded on a Pacific island with no spa. I head directly to my room and lock the door. While waiting for my laptop to boot, I realize that I didn't see something inside Limpy's van that logically should have been there, the remote control unit for the runaway quadcopter. I insert the SD card into my laptop and find two videos in the file. The most recent is 4 minutes and 20 seconds long, from takeoff to crash. At the start of the video, I recognize the launch point as a nearby city park, and at the end, I recognize the kid aiming his slingshot up at the quadcopter. I'm a little surprised by the cold look on my face. The second video on the SD card is longer, the timestamp showing that it was recorded yesterday morning. From the rising drone, you can see a busy public boat ramp on the Indian River Lagoon. I've been there before. Judging from the angle of the sunlight, the craft takes a southern flight path, swooping above sailboats and jet skis and fishing skiffs. Eventually it slows to a hover above a stand of Australian pines on a shoreline that also looks familiar. Slowly, the drone spins in place, the camera sweeping the trees. And there it is, in a half-dead pine, the nest. And over there, high in a different tree, is one of Mom's two cherished eagles. Its snow-white head cocks upward, suspiciously eyeing the noisy little invader. The other bird is busy pecking apart a dead mullet on another branch. With a cry, the first baldy takes flight. The sudden tilt of the video frame indicates the drone has banked sharply, trying to race away. You catch a glimpse of a flapping shadow in hot pursuit, but the quadcopter is too speedy. The bird can't catch up. I wonder if it was hungry or just pissed off.
On the return flight to the boat ramp, the drone dips and weaves like a crazed fruit bat. The camera keeps recording, so I pay close attention to the landing. There's a man on the ground holding the remote control. As the aircraft descends, the man's image in the frame grows larger and larger, and he looks less and less like Limpy the surfer. I pluck the SD card from my computer and bolt out of the house so fast that Mom doesn't have time to ask where I'm going. One time I saw a guy run over a snake on purpose. It was a pretty little king snake, totally harmless, crossing Strathman Lane early one Saturday morning. There was no car traffic, just me on foot with a fishing rod. I was hurrying to move the snake off the road when some jerk on a bright yellow motorcycle swerved across the center line and drove over it. Then he slowed down, glanced back to make sure he'd struck his target, and sped off. He wasn't wearing a helmet, so I got a quick look at his scraggly, smirking face. Because of its long, winding nervous system, a snake that gets badly injured takes a long time to die. It's not a pleasant way to go. I set this one in the bushes and waited until it stopped moving. Then I covered the shiny black and gold body with handfuls of dirt. Not much of a funeral, but I was in a rush. It was a short jog home, where I jumped on my bike and started riding up and down every street in my neighborhood, then the next neighborhood over, and so on. Eventually, I found the yellow motorcycle. It was parked at a one-story house that needed new shingles and a paint job. The shaggy driver was lounging out front, drinking a Mountain Dew and gadding on a cell phone. He paid no attention as I rode by. What happened later isn't important. The snake killer's motorcycle mysteriously ended up at the bottom of a canal, is what I heard. When he went to the police station, they saw that he had like 17 unpaid traffic tickets, so now he pedals around town on a bicycle like mine. The point of the story is that patience is important when you're hunting for something, whether it's a snake or a motorcycle or a rainbow-colored beach van. It turns out that Limpy lives only 8 streets from my house. There's plenty of daylight left when I spot his van under an oak tree next to an apartment building. The second door I knock on belongs to Limpy, who's surprised to see me.
"What's up, dude?"
he says, in a voice just shy of friendly. "Here, I found this." I hold up the little SD card. Limpy squints, totally puzzled. "It must have popped out of your drone," I say, "when it crashed."
"It did? Oh, wow."
"You know what it is, right?" Limpy purses his lips.
"Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. It's, you know, one of those thingies."
Quickly, I slip past him into the apartment.
"Okay, where is he?"
Limpy wheels around.
"Whoa, dude, where's who?"
"The man who owns the drone."
"I don't know what you're talking about. The man who paid you to come get it from my front yard," I say.
Limpy sniffs, looks down at his sandy bare feet, then back up at me.
"Listen, dude."
"No, you listen." I waggle the SD card in front of him. "This is not a thingy. It's a miniature data board for storing photos and video. Anybody who's into drones would know that. Speaking of which, where is it?" "Your quadcopter, Limpy."
"My what?"
"Oh, come on." I motion around the inside of the apartment, which is basically a minefield of surfboards, skimboards, skateboards, styrofoam fast food cartons, and mounds of reeking laundry. Yet no drone.
"Dude, just get the hell out of here,"
says Limpy, and he's large enough to make me. "Not until you tell me where he is."
"Hey, do I look like some kind of rat?"
Actually, Limpy does sort of resemble a 160-pound rodent. It sounds mean, but the truth is the truth. I don't have a problem with surfers. They're fine.
a kid in my sister's class is crazy good on a short board. He gets all A's and B's, and he's going to the University of California in San Diego. Limpy, I'm guessing, wasn't much of a student. I smile at him and say, "The license tag on your van expired 8 months ago. You're lucky some cop hasn't noticed." He grabs his head.
"Dude, why are you busting my butt? What are you, like 13? Who do you think you freaking are?"
"Just a law-abiding citizen," I reply, trying to find his father. Limpy's expression gets cloudy as his brain struggles to fit all this information together. "How much did he pay you?" I ask. "Don't worry, you don't have to give the money back."
$20, he mumbles.
"How'd you meet him?" "I was parking at that IHOP round the corner, okay? And he pulled up beside me and asked, do I want to make some easy cash? He was in a mega hurry, said his RC drone went down, and could I go pick it up for him?"
Didn't it seem weird that he wouldn't go get it himself?
"People are weird, dude. I don't judge."
I describe what my father looks like, and Limpy says it sounds like the same guy. I'm working real hard to stay cool. "Was he driving a red Chevy King cab?" Limpy nods.
"Covered with dust. I mean, it was dog dirty."
A subject on which Limpy is an expert. "Did you take the drone back to the IHOP?" I ask.
"Nah, some motel down Highway 1. He paid me the 20 and I drove home. Well, not straight home. I stopped to pick up groceries."
Limpy's so-called groceries are on the kitchen table. A tube of Pringles and a 12-pack of beer. "Which motel?" I ask.
"I don't remember the name."
"Then take me there."
"What?" Limpy whines. "Give me a break, man."
"I'll put my bike in the back of your van and you can drop me off. Let's go." Limpy folds his ropey brown arms.
"So, this guy's really your dad?"
"Yep."
"But then, how come he's spying on you?"
"That's messed up, dude." "It sure is," I say. 9. The sun goes down. I'm sitting on my bike in front of the Purple Pelican Motel. There's no sign of a Chevy King cab with Montana license plates. I've got the phone to my ear waiting for Summer Chasing Hawks to pick up on the other end. She doesn't. I've already texted her like 9 times and gotten no reply. My next call is to Little Thunder Sky.
"Hello there, Billy Big Stick," she says.
"I've been trying to reach Summer, but she's hiking up Mill Creek. There's no cell signal on the mountain."
"It's about my dad," I say to Lil. "Is he in Florida?"
"That would be news to me. The note he dropped to me on the river said he'd be coming here, but it didn't say when. I didn't tell you about it because I figured it was just him, you know, trying to make me feel better."
Lil says she hasn't spoken to my father in days.
"Said he's off on another mission, but as usual, he didn't say where."
I tell her about the mystery quadcopter, Limpy, and the dusty red truck.
"Him and that drone," Lil sighs wearily. "Why can't he just walk up and say hi like a regular person?"
"Sorry, gotta go." I hop off my bike and duck behind a bus stop bench. A big red pickup has wheeled into the motel parking lot. A slender man steps down from the driver's side holding a white bag. It's too dark to see his face. I try to shout, "Dad!" but only a raw croak comes out. Pathetic. The man enters one of the ground floor rooms. When the lights come on, the blinds snap shut. My phone vibrates. It's Mom calling, but I don't answer. Instead, I text her with shaky fingers, "I'm chillin' at Dex's."
"Don't be too late," she texts back.
"Kay." True confession, I don't know anybody named Dex. In fact,
I don't know anybody who knows anybody named Dex. A more experienced liar would have come up with a normal-sounding fake friend. I lock my bike to the bench and sneak over to the red pickup. It's got Montana license tags, new rear tires, and a gritty coat of dust. However, one of the fenders has a dime-sized puncture that I don't remember seeing when we came upon Dad's truck in the Tom Minor Basin. The hole might explain the gunshot that the Forest Service officer was on his way to investigate when he saw me hitchhiking. Traffic is heavy tonight, and I'm worried that the passing headlights will reveal me crouching like a burglar by the motel. I ease into the shadows to plan my next move, and it turns out I'm not alone. Two heavy-set dudes in t-shirts are leaning against the wall, sharing a bottle of booze.
"Gimme your money,"
one of them says casually.
"Are you kidding?"
"Right now," says the other one, gulping from the bottle.
I can't see their expressions, but they sound fairly serious. "I don't have any money," I say, which is the truth. My fists are clenched, but my whole body is shaking. The first guy grabs the front of my shirt. He smells like cigarettes and rotten fruit.
"Empty your pockets or we kick your ass."
"Yo, I don't think so."
I'm almost sure this is not me speaking. The dude lets go of my shirt and takes a step back. I truly cannot move a muscle.
"I'll put both you dumb suckers down," says the unseen owner of the voice, which I now recognize.
The two muggers slink away, cussing. A hand settles on my shoulder.
"You all right, Snake Boy?"
"I'm good. Thanks, Jammer." When he steps from the shadow, I see a straight blade in his right hand. He snaps it shut.
"Ain't no rattlesnake," he says with a hard smile, "but I can sure make it bite."
"You saved me a trip to the hospital."
"Go on home, bro. This ain't no place for you to be hanging."
Jammer slides away slow and easy, like he owns the street. I watch until he disappears around a corner. Maybe he felt like he owed me a favor, but all I did was let him borrow my phone the day his car broke down. That's nothing compared to what he just did for me. After taking a slow, deep breath, I approach the door to the motel room, knock three times, and wait. Nothing happens. I knock again, louder this time.
"Dad, it's me! Open up!"
No sounds of movement on the other side. Did he fall asleep? Or is he hunkered down, waiting for me to go away? Knock, knock, knock. I'm not giving up, Dennis. Deal with it. Knock, 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 knock! He'd have to be in a coma not to hear me. I back off and press myself against the wall, half expecting to see the two muggers returning with backup. I'm wondering if I'll have time to dial 911 before they punch my lights out. Several minutes later, the motel room door cracks open. A head pokes out briefly, then disappears. After a while, the man emerges and strides toward the red truck. I step forward, yelling,
"Hey, you! Wait!"
And what does he do? My own flesh and blood? He runs. Unbelievable.
"Are you nuts?"
I shout after him. He glances back, but he doesn't stop. It's pitiful, really, because he's not very fast. I catch up quickly and tackle him from behind. So this is quite a father and son reunion, the two of us rolling around on the sidewalk along U.S. Highway 1. Once I get him pinned, I say,
"What is your problem, Dad?"
He's panting like an old dog.
"Billy Dickens, is that you? Let me up, son. You gonna chill or not?" "We'd better get out of here before somebody calls the cops. We look like two drunks wrestling in the road."
"No, the wrestling part is over," I say. This is the part where you say you're sorry for running away from your own kid.
You scared me, Billy. I swear I didn't know it was you.
I won't let him up until I'm sure he's too tired to take off again.
Did you come alone?
He asks. No, Dad, I brought SEAL Team 6. I pull him to his feet and we go back to his motel room. In the light, he looks just like he did in the photographs at Summer and Lil's house, except tonight he's wearing a wrinkled black business suit, black shoes, a white button-down shirt, and a crooked black checked necktie.
Are you going to a funeral? I ask. Actually, I was on my way to see you, he says, and your sister. I'm real nervous, to be honest. That's why I did the flyover with the quadcopter. I didn't want to show up at the front door and find out your mom's got a jealous boyfriend or whatever.
Dad's damp hair is mussed from our scuffle. His cheeks are flushed and shiny with sweat. I point to the drone parked on the floor. Am I the first person to shoot at that thing?
No, but you're the first one to hit it.
He's still breathing hard.
Good thing all you had was a slingshot.
Who put that bullet hole in your truck?
Dad chuckles sourly. It's what they call an occupational hazard.
And your occupation is...
Geez, your mom never told me you play football.
I don't.
Then where'd you learn to tackle like that?
He's rubbing his left side.
I think you busted some ribs.
There's definitely something familiar about his voice. Is it possible my brain remembers it from all those years ago, before he left us?
Why didn't you answer the stupid door? I knocked like 100 times.
I was in the shower.
He holds out his right hand.
Good to see you, son.
We shake. I nod stiffly.
Good to see you too. In person, I mean.
I should probably be angrier than I feel, but I admit there's a huge sense of relief to be done with the first face-to-face moment, as crazy as it was. At least no punches were thrown. A white paper bag from McDonald's sits open on top of the TV set. The whole room smells like fries. In one corner is a large black duffel, zipped tight. When I sit down on the edge of the bed, the flimsy mattress sags. My father remains standing. He smooths his hair and brushes the smudges from the knees of his pants.
I was going to the house to apologize, he says.
For everything? Wow.
Do you think your mom and sister will want to see me?
Is that really why you came to Florida?
Full disclosure, I'm also here on business.
Now we're getting somewhere. A big-ass cockroach emerges from the closet and crawls halfway across the floor before Dad says,
Your call, Billy.
I motion to the door. He opens it. Together we watch the shiny brown fugitive scurry into the night. My father shuts the door and grins.
Most guys would have stomped that thing, he says.
I didn't want to mess up this lovely slime-green carpet. Why wouldn't you come out of the woods and talk to me in Montana?
It wasn't safe. I was working.
So, tell me about this top-secret job. Lil said you do surveillance missions for the government? I do semi-snarky air quotes when I say the word missions. My father's brow creases and his lower jaw grinds. I hardly know the man, but it's clear he can't decide how much of the truth to tell me. Is it the CIA? FBI? I ask. The NSA?
Let's go outside, Billy.
Are you going to run again? Because, no offense, you're not exactly Usain Bolt.
No, son. I'm done running, he says.
Belinda and I have one living set of grandparents, Mom's father and mother. They live in Portland, Oregon, on the other side of the country, which means we see them only at Christmas. That's the time of year when Florida gets invaded by jillions of grandfathers and grandmothers desperate to escape winter. Grandpa Dan is retired from Boeing in Seattle, where he worked on an assembly line building jet airplanes, mostly 737s. Grandma Jackie taught elementary school for 30 years. In addition to my mom, they had 4 other daughters, so now there are at least a dozen other grandkids scattered all over the place, my cousins. Honestly, I can't even name them all. Belinda and I have met only a few, and they seemed fairly normal. It's possible we'll never get to know the rest, because Mom's not real tight with her sisters. Besides, we move around so often that they've probably lost track of us. On the other side of the family, there are no cousins or aunts or uncles, because Dad was an only child. Mom said it was a brutal time for him when his mother and father passed away. How could it not be? Dad's father had one sister, Sophie was her name, who made sure he was able to finish college. He might have mentioned her when we were little, but I can't remember. "Aunt Sophie," says my father, "was an odd character, though very kind to me. She lived all alone on a little island in the Bahamas." "That's cool. What did her house look like?"
"I've got no idea, Billy. She never invited me to visit. In fact, I never met the lady in person."
We're standing on top of the drawbridge that crosses the Indian River Lagoon. A breeze ripples the water, and I can see the red and green lights of the channel markers winking all the way up to Vero Beach. A power line strung parallel to the causeway is lined with birds, gray doves, I think, dozing shoulder to shoulder. There must be 100 of them. I ask Dad if he and his rich aunt ever spoke on the phone.
"Just twice. The first time was the day after my parents died. The second time was the day after I graduated from college. She called to congratulate me. She asked what I intended to do with my brand new bachelor's degree in wildlife ecology and conservation. I made up something that sounded righteous and noble, but I had no grand plan, obviously. Your mom found that out the hard way."
We're in a narrow pedestrian lane used mostly by fishermen. Wearing a black suit at nighttime makes Dad almost invisible to drivers, but luckily there's not much traffic. Since we've been here, the drawbridge has gone up only once for a northbound sailboat. Below us, a pod of bottle-nosed dolphins plays in the waves. I hear them breathing through their blowholes. It sounds like soft valves on a steam engine.
"This would be an excellent place to launch the drone," Dad says.
I'm not sure how Aunt Sophie is connected to his secret missions, but I'm trying to stay patient and polite. Mom keeps texting, asking why the heck I haven't come home.
"Speaking of drones," I say, "did the government train you how to fly that thing?" "I taught myself. It's easy, really."
"But they paid for it, right? The CIA? Or whoever?"
He shakes his head. "No, Billy. Aunt Sophie paid for it."
"But you made it sound like she's dead."
"Oh, she is."
"This isn't funny, Dad." I start walking down the bridge back toward the mainland. My father hustles after me.
"Wait, son, listen," he's saying.
"Not long after I moved to Montana. After you bailed on Mom and us, right? Don't forget that part."
"All right, yes. After I went to Montana, I got a phone call from some lawyer in Nassau. He told me Aunt Sophie had passed away and left everything to me and her pet parrot. I couldn't believe it."
Now I'm walking faster. Apparently, my father thinks I'm a total fool.
"Please slow down, Billy. These church shoes are killing my feet."
"What was the parrot's name? Make it a good one, Dad."
"She called it Hubert, after the Prime Minister at the time."
"Sure, of course she did," I say. "I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. She and the Prime Minister were friends.
Wait up!
So how much did rich Aunt Sophie leave you and Hubert the parrot?"
"Enough," Dad says.
"Enough for what?"
"To take care of you, your sister, and your mom. And Lil and Summer, too."
"Okay, but why do you need the money if you're flying spy quadcopters for the U.S. government? I'm sure the pay's pretty sweet. He grabs one of my arms and hangs on until I stop walking. We've almost reached the bottom of the bridge.
Son, I don't work for the government, he says. I work for myself.
Doing what?
Lil does.